bed next to Lloyd Henreid and had told him that if Lloyd was interested in a big score, he knew about something interesting in Vegas. Lloyd was willing. Lloyd was released on June 1st. His crime, committed in Reno, had been attempted rape. The lady was a showgirl on her way home, and she had shot a load of tear gas into Lloyd's eyes. He felt lucky to get only 2 to 4, plus time served, plus time off for good behavior. At Brownsville, it was just too fucking hot to misbehave. He caught a bus to Las Vegas, and Polk met him at the terminal. This was the deal, Polk told him. He knew this guy. One-time business associate might describe him best. And this guy was known in certain circles as Gorgeous George. He did some piecework for a group of people with mostly Italian and Sicilian names. George was strictly part-time help. What he did mostly for these Sicilian-type people was to take things and bring things. Sometimes he took things from Vegas to L.A. Sometimes he brought other things from L.A. to Vegas. Small-time dope, mostly. Freebies for big-time customers. Sometimes guns. The guns were always a bring, never a take. As Polk understood it, and Polk's understanding never got much beyond what the movie people call soft focus, these Sicilian-type people sometimes sold iron to independent thieves. Well, Polk said, Gorgeous George was willing to tell them the time and place when a fairly good haul of these items would be in the offing. George was asking 25% of what they realized. Polk and Lloyd would crash in on George, tie him and gag him, take the stuff, and maybe give him a couple of biffs and baffs for good measure. It had to look good, George had cautioned, because these Sicilian-type people were no one to fool around with. Well, Lloyd said, it sounds good. The next day, Polk and Lloyd went to see Gorgeous George, a mild-mannered six-footer with a small head which sat incongruously above his roof-beam shoulders on a neck which did not seem to exist. He had a full head of waved blonde hair, which made him look a bit like the famed wrestler. Lloyd had had second thoughts about the deal, but Polk had changed his mind again. Polk was good at that. George told them to come around to his house the following Friday evening around 6. "Wear masks, for God's sake," he said. "And you'll bloody my nose and black my eye, too. Jesus, I wish I'd never gotten into this." The big night came. Polk and Lloyd took a bus to the corner of George's street and put on ski masks at the foot of his walk. The door was locked, but as George had promised, not too tightly locked. There was a rumpus room downstairs, and there was George standing in front of a hefty bag full of pot. The ping-pong table was loaded down with guns. George was scared. "Jesus, oh Jesus, I wish I'd never gotten into this," he kept saying as Lloyd tied his feet with clothes rope and Polk bound his hands with Scotch brand filament tape. Then Lloyd biffed George in the nose, bloodying it, and Polk baffed him in the eye, blacking it as per request. "Jeez," George cried. "Did you have to do it so hard?" "You were the one wanted to make sure it looked good," Lloyd pointed out. Polk plastered a piece of adhesive tape across George's mouth. The two of them had begun to gather up the swag. "You know something, old buddy?" Polk said, pausing. "Nope," Lloyd said, giggling nervously. "Not a thing." "I wonder if old George there can keep a secret." For Lloyd, this was a brand new consideration. He stared thoughtfully at Gorgeous George for a long, hard minute. George's eyes bugged back at him in sudden terror. Then Lloyd said, "Sure, it's his ass, too." But he sounded as uneasy as he felt. When certain seeds are planted, they nearly always grow. Polk smiled. "Oh, he could just say, 'Hey, guys, I met this old friend and his buddy. We shot the ship for a while, had a few beers, and what do you think, the sons of bitches came over to the house and took me off? Sure hope you catch 'em. Let me tell you what they look like.'" George was shaking his head wildly, his eyes capital O's of terror. The guns were by then in a heavy canvas laundry sack they had found in the downstairs bathroom. Now Lloyd hefted the bag nervously and said, "Well, what do you think we ought to do?" "I think we ought to pokerize him, old buddy," Polk said regretfully. "Only thing we can do." Lloyd said, "That seems awful hard after he put us onto this." "Hard old world, buddy." "Yeah," Lloyd sighed, and they walked over to George. "Oof!" George said, shaking his head wildly. "Oof, oof, oof!" I know, Poke soothed him. Bitch, ain't it? I'm sorry, George, no shit. It ain't a bit personal. Want you to remember that. Catch on his head, Lloyd. That was easier said than done. Gorgeous George was whipping his head wildly from side to side. He was sitting in the corner of his rumpus room, and the walls were cinder block, and he kept rapping his head against them. Didn't even seem to feel it. Catch him, Poke said serenely, and ripped another piece of tape from the roll. Lloyd at last got him by the hair and managed to hold him still long enough for Poke to slap the second strip of adhesive neatly across George's nose, thereby sealing all of his tubes. George went purely crazy. He rolled out of the corner, belly-whopped, and then lay there, humping the floor and making muffled sounds which Lloyd supposed were supposed to be screams. Poor old fellow. It went on for almost 5 minutes before George was completely still. He bucked and scrabbled and thumped. His face got as red as the side of old Dad's barn. The last thing he did was to lift both legs 8 or 10 inches straight up off the floor and bring them down with a crash. It reminded Lloyd of something he had seen in a Bugs Bunny cartoon or something, and he chuckled a little, feeling a bit cheered up. Up until then, it had been sort of gruesome to see. Poke squatted beside George and felt for his pulse. Well, Lloyd said.
Nothing ticking but his watch, old buddy, Poke said. Speaking of which.
He lifted George's meaty arm and looked at his wrist.
No, just a Timex. I was thinking it might be a Casio, something like that.
He let George's arm drop. George's car keys were in his front pants pocket, and in an upstairs cupboard they found a Skippy peanut butter jar half filled with dimes, and they took those too. There was $20.60 in dimes. George's car was a wheezy old Mustang with a four on the floor and lousy shocks and tires that were as bald as Telly Savalas. They left Vegas on U.S. 93 and went southeast into Arizona. By noon of the next day, day before yesterday, they had skirted Phoenix on the back roads. Yesterday, around 9, they had stopped at a dusty old general store 2 miles beyond Sheldon on Arizona Highway 75. They knocked over the store and pokerized the proprietor, an elderly gentleman with mail-order false teeth. They got $63 and the old Dudemars pickup truck. The pickup truck had blown 2 tires this morning. 2 tires at the same time, and neither of them could find any tacks or nails on the road at all, although they spent nearly half an hour looking, swapping a bomber joint back and forth as they did so. Poke finally said it must have been a coincidence. Lloyd said he had heard of stranger things, by God. Then along came the white Connie, like an answer to their prayers. They had crossed the state line from Arizona into New Mexico earlier on, although neither of them knew it, and so they had become meat for the FBI. The Connie's driver had pulled over, leaned out, and said, "Need any help?"
"Sure do," Poke had said,
and pokerized the guy right on the spot. Got him dead bang between the eyes with the .357 mag. Poor sucker probably never even knew what had hit him. "Why don't you turn here?" Lloyd said, pointing to the junction coming up. He was pleasantly stoned.
"Sure could," Poke said cheerfully.
He let the Connie's speed drop from 80 to 60, drifted it to the left, right wheels barely leaving the ground, and then a new piece of road was unrolling in front of them. Route 78, due west. And so, not knowing they had ever left it or that they were now the perpetrators of what the newspapers were calling a tri-state kill spree, they re-entered Arizona. About an hour later, a sign came up on their right. Burrick, 6.
Burlap?
Lloyd said foggily.
Burrick,
Poke said, and began twisting the Connie's wheel so that the car made big, graceful loops back and forth across the road.
Whoop! Whoop!
You want to stop there? I'm hungry, man.
You're always hungry.
Fuck you, when I get stoned, I get the munchies.
You can munch on my 9-inch hog leg, how's that? Whoop! Whoop!
Seriously, Poke, let's stop.
Okay. Got to get some cash, too. We've thrown off enough fucking pursuit for a while. We got to get some money and shag ass north. This desert shit makes no sense to me.
Okay, Lloyd said. He didn't know if it was the dope working on him or what, but all of a sudden he felt paranoid as hell, even worse than when they had been on the turnpike. Polk was right. Stop outside this Burrick and pull a score like they had outside of Sheldon. Get some money and some gas station maps. Ditch this fucking Connie for something that would blend into the scenery. Then head north and east by the secondary roads. Get the fuck out of Arizona.
I'll tell you the truth, man, Polk said. All of a sudden I feel as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs.
I know what you mean, Jelly Bean, Lloyd said gravely. And then it hit them both funny, and they broke up. Burrick was a wide place in the road. They shot through it, and on the other side was a combination cafe, store, and gas station. There was an old Ford wagon and a dust-streaked Olds with a horse trailer behind it in the dirt parking lot. The horse stared out at them as Polk wheeled the Connie in.
This looks like just the ticket, Lloyd said.
Polk agreed. He reached into the back for the 357 and checked the loads.
You ready?
I guess so, Lloyd said, and took hold of the Schmeisser. They walked across the baked parking lot. The police had known who they were for 4 days now. They had left their fingerprints all over Gorgeous George's house and in the store where the old man with the mail-order dentures had been pokerized. The old man's pickup had been found within 50 feet of the bodies of the three people who belonged with the Continental, and it seemed reasonable to assume that the men who had killed Gorgeous George and the store owner had also killed these three. If they had been listening to the Connie's radio instead of the tape player, they would have known that Arizona and New Mexico police were coordinating the largest manhunt in 40 years, all for a couple of small-time grifters who could not quite comprehend what they might have done to start such a fuss. The gas was self-service. The clerk had to turn on the pump. So they went up the steps and inside. Three aisles of canned goods went up the room toward the counter. At the counter, a man in cowboy clothes was paying for a pack of smokes and half a dozen Slim Jims. Halfway down the middle aisle, a tired-looking woman with coarse black hair was trying to decide between two brands of spaghetti sauce. The place smelled of stale licorice and sun and tobacco and age. The proprietor was a freckled man in a gray shirt. He was wearing a company cap that said Shell in red letters against a white field. He looked up as the screen door slapped shut, and his eyes widened. Lloyd put the wire stock of the Schmeisser against his shoulder and fired a burst at the ceiling. The two hanging light bulbs shattered like bombs. The man in the cowboy clothes began to turn around.
"Just hold still and nobody'll get hurt," Lloyd shouted.
And Polk immediately made him a liar by blowing a hole through the woman looking at the sauces. She flew out of her shoes.
"Holy gee, Polk!" Lloyd hollered. "You didn't have to pokerize her, old buddy!" Polk yelled. "She'll never watch Jerry Falwell again! Whoop! Whoop!"
The man in the cowboy clothes kept turning. He was holding his smokes in his left hand. The harsh light falling through the show window and the screen door pricked out bright stars on the dark lenses of his sunglasses. There was a .45 revolver tucked into his belt, and now he plucked it out unhurriedly as Lloyd and Polk were staring at the dead woman. He aimed, fired, and the left side of Polk's face suddenly disappeared in a spray of blood and tissue and teeth.
"Shot!"
Polk screamed, dropping the .357 and flailing backward. His flailing hands raked potato chips and taco chips and cheese doodles onto the splintery wooden floor.
"Shot me, Lloyd! Look out! Shot me! Shot me!"
He hit the screen door and it slammed open, and Polk sat down hard on the porch outside, pulling one of the aged door hinges loose. Lloyd, stunned, fired more in reflex than in self-defense. The Schmeisser's roar filled the room. Cans flew, bottles crashed, spilling ketchup, pickles, olives. The glass front of the Pepsi cooler jingled inward. Bottles of Dr. Pepper and Jolt and Orange Crush exploded like clay pigeons. Foam ran everywhere. The man in the cowboy clothes, cool, calm, and collected, fired his piece again. Lloyd felt rather than heard the bullet as it droned by nearly close enough to part hair. He raked the Schmeisser across the room from left to right. The man in the shell cap dropped behind the counter with such suddenness that an observer might have thought a trap door had been sprung on him. A gumball machine disintegrated. Red, blue, and green chews rolled everywhere. The glass bottles on the counter exploded. One of them had contained pickled eggs. Another, pickled pig's feet. Immediately, the room was filled with the sharp odor of vinegar. The Schmeisser put 3 bullet holes in the cowboy's khaki shirt, and most of his innards exited from the back to splatter all over Spuds McKenzie. The cowboy went down, still clutching his .45 in one hand and his deck of luckies in the other. Lloyd, bullshit with fear, continued to fire. The machine pistol was growing hot in his hands. A box filled with returnable soda bottles tinkled and fell over. A calendar girl wearing hot pants took a bullet hole in one magical peach-colored thigh. A rack of paperbacks with no covers crashed over. Then the Schmeisser was empty, and the new silence was deafening. The smell of gunpowder was heavy and rank.
"Holy gee," Lloyd said.
He looked cautiously at the cowboy. It didn't look like the cowboy was going to be a problem in either the near or distant future.
"Shot me!"
Poke brayed, and staggered back inside. He clawed the screen door out of his way with such force that the other hinge popped and the door slapped onto the porch.
"Shot me, Lloyd! Look out!"
"I got him, Poke,"
Lloyd soothed, but Poke seemed not to hear. He was a mess. His right eye blazed like a baleful sapphire. The left was gone. His left cheek had been vaporized. You could watch his jaw work on that side as he talked. Most of his teeth were gone over there, too. His shirt was soaked with blood. When you got right down to it, Poke was sort of a mess.
"Stupid fuck blew me up!"
Poke screamed. He bent over and got the .357 mag.
"I'll teach you to shoot me, you dumb fuck!"
He advanced on the cowboy, a rural Dr. Sardonicus. He put one foot on the cowboy's butt like a hunter posing for a picture with the bear which would soon be decorating the wall of his den, and prepared to empty the .357 into his head. Lloyd stood watching, gape-mouthed, the smoking machine pistol dangling from one hand, still trying to figure out how all of this had happened. At that moment, the man in the shell cap popped back up from behind the counter like Jack from his box, his face screwed up in an expression of desperate intent, a double-barreled shotgun clutched in both hands.
"Huh?"
Poke said, and looked up just in time to get both barrels. He went down, his face a worse mess than ever and not caring a bit. Lloyd decided it was time to leave. Fuck the money. There was money everywhere. The time to throw off a little more pursuit had clearly come. He wheeled and exited the store in large, shambling strides, his boots barely touching the boards. He was halfway down the steps when an Arizona State Police cruiser wheeled into the yard. A trooper got out on the passenger side and pulled his pistol.
"Hold it right there. What's going on in there?"
"3 people dead," Lloyd cried. "Hell of a mess. Guy that did it went out the back. I'm getting the fuck out."
He ran to the Connie, had actually slipped behind the wheel and was just remembering that the keys were in Poke's pocket when the trooper yelled,
"Halt! Halt or I'll shoot!"
Lloyd halted. After examining the radical surgery on Poke's face, it didn't take a long time to decide he'd just as soon pass.
"Holy gee," he said miserably as a second trooper laid a big horse pistol upside his head.
The first one cuffed him.
"In the back of the cruiser, Sonny Jim."
The man in the shell cap had come out onto the porch, still clutching his shotgun.
"He shot Bill Markson," he yelled in a high, queer voice. "T'other one shot Mrs. Storm. Hell of a note. I shot t'other one. He's deader than a shitbug. Like to shoot this one, too, if you boys'll stand away."
"Calm down, Pop," one of the troopers said. "Fun's over."
"I'll shoot him where he stands," the old guy yelled. "I'll lay him low."
Then he leaned forward like an English butler making a bow and threw up on his shoes.
"You boys get me away from that guy, would you?" Lloyd said. "I believe he's crazy."
"You got this coming out of the store, Sonny Jim," the trooper who had thrown down on him in the first place said. The barrel of his pistol looped up and up, catching the sun, and then it crashed down on Lloyd Henreid's head, and he never woke up until that evening in the Apache County Jail's infirmary.
Chapter 17 Starkey was standing in front of Monitor 2, keeping a close eye on Tech Second Class Frank D. Bruce. When we last saw Bruce, he was face down in a bowl of chunky sirloin soup. No change except for the positive ID. Situation normal. All fucked up. Thoughtfully, hands locked behind his back like a general reviewing troops, like General Blackjack Pershing, his boyhood idol, Starkey moved down to Monitor 4, where the situation had changed for the better. Dr. Emmanuel Eswick still lay dead on the floor, but the centrifuge had stopped. At 1940 hours last night, the centrifuge had begun to emit fine tendrils of smoke. At 1945 hours, the sound pickups in Eswick's lab had transmitted a wunga-wunga-wunga sort of sound that deepened into a fuller, richer, and more satisfying ronk-ronk-ronk. At 2107 hours, the centrifuge had ronked its last ronk and had slowly come to rest. Was it Newton who had said that somewhere, beyond the farthest star, there may be a body perfectly at rest? Newton had been right about everything but the distance, Starkey thought. He didn't have to go far at all. Project Blue was perfectly at rest. Starkey was very glad. The centrifuge had been the last illusion of life, and the problem he'd had Steffens run through the main computer bank, Steffens had looked at him as though he were crazy, and yes, Starkey thought he might be, was, how long could that centrifuge be expected to run? The answer, which had come back in 6.6 seconds, was, plus or minus 3 years, probable malfunction next 2 weeks, 0.009%. Areas of probable malfunction, bearings 38%, main motor 16%, all other 54%. That was a smart computer. Starkey had gotten Steffens to query it again after the actual burnout of Eswick's centrifuge. The computer communed with the engineering system's data bank and confirmed that the centrifuge had indeed burned out its bearings. Remember that, Starkey thought, as his caller began to beep urgently behind him. The sound of burning bearings in the final stages of collapse is ronk, ronk, ronk. He went to the caller and pushed the button that snapped off the beeper. Yes, Len? Billy, I've got an urgent from one of our teams in a town called Sipe Springs, Texas, almost 400 miles from Arnett. They say they have to talk to you. It's a command decision. What is it, Len? He asked calmly. He had taken over 16 downers in the last 10 hours and was, generally speaking, feeling fine. Not a sign of a ronk. Press. Oh, Jesus, Starkey said mildly. Patch them through. There was a muffled roar of static with a voice talking unintelligibly behind it. Wait a minute, Len said. The static slowly cleared. Lion, Team Lion, do you read Blue Base? Can you read? 1, 2, 3, 4, this is Team Lion. I've got you, Team Lion, Starkey said. This is Blue Base 1. Problem is coded flowerpot in the contingency book, the tinny voice said. Repeat flowerpot. I know what the fuck flowerpot is, Starkey said. What's the situation? The tinny voice coming from Sipe Springs talked uninterrupted for almost 5 minutes. The situation itself was unimportant, Starkey thought, because the computer had informed him 2 days ago that just this sort of situation, in some shape or form, was apt to occur before the end of June. 88% probability. The specifics didn't matter. If it had two legs and belt loops, it was a pair of pants. Never mind the color. A doctor in Sipe Springs had made some good guesses, and a pair of reporters for a Houston Daily had linked what was happening in Sipe Springs with what had already happened in Arnett, Verona, Commerce City, and a town called Polleston, Kansas. Those were the towns where the problem had gotten so bad so fast that the army had been sent into quarantine. The computer had a list of 25 other towns in 10 states where traces of blue were beginning to show up. The Sipe Springs situation wasn't important because it wasn't unique. They'd had their chance at unique in Arnett. Well, maybe. And flubbed it. What was important was that the situation was finally going to see print on something besides yellow military flimsy. Was, anyway, unless Starkey took steps. He hadn't decided whether to do that or not. But when the tinny voice stopped talking, Starkey realized that he had made the decision after all. He had perhaps made it as long as 20 years ago. It came down to what was important. And what was important wasn't the fact of the disease. It wasn't the fact that Atlanta's integrity had somehow been breached and they were going to have to switch the whole preventative operation to much less satisfactory facilities in Stovington, Vermont. It wasn't the fact that blue spread in such sneaky common cold disguise. What is important? Say again, Blue Base One, the voice said anxiously. We did not copy. What was important was that a regrettable incident had occurred. Starkey flashed back in time 22 years to 1968. He had been in the officers' club in San Diego when the news came about Cali and what had happened at Mealy 4. Starkey had been playing poker with 4 other men, 2 of whom now sat on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The poker game had been forgotten, utterly forgotten, in the discussion of exactly what this was going to do to the military, not any one branch but the entire military, in the witch-hunt atmosphere of Washington's 4th Estate. And one of their number, a man who could now dial directly to the miserable worm who had been masquerading as a chief executive since January 20, 1989, had laid his cards carefully down on the green felt table, and he had said, "Gentlemen, a regrettable incident has occurred. And when a regrettable incident occurs which involves any branch of the United States military, we don't question the roots of that incident, but rather how the branches may best be pruned. The service is mother and father to us. And if you find your mother raped or your father beaten and robbed, before you call the police or begin an investigation, you cover their nakedness, because you love them." Starkey had never heard anyone talk so well before or since. Now he unlocked the bottom drawer of his desk and fumbled out a thin blue folder bound with red tape. The legend written on the cover read, "If tape is broken, notify all security divisions at once." Starkey broke the tape. "Are you there, Blue Base One?" the voice was asking. "We do not copy you. Repeat, do not copy." "I'm here, Lion," Starkey said. He had flipped to the last page of the book, and now his finger ran down a column labeled Extreme Covert Countermeasures. "Lion, do you read?" "We read 5 by, Blue Base One." "Troy," Starkey said deliberately. "I repeat, Lion, Troy. Repeat back, please. Over to you." Silence. A faraway mumble of static. Starkey was fleetingly reminded of the walkie-talkies they made as kids. 2 tin Del Monte cans and 20 yards of waxed string. "I say again, oh, Jesus!" a very young voice in Sipe Springs gulped. "Repeat back, son," Starkey said.
"Troy,"
the voice said. Then more strongly,
"Troy."
"Very good," Starkey said calmly. "God bless you, son. Over and out."
"And you, sir. Over and out."
A click, followed by heavy static, followed by another click, silence, and Len Creighton's voice. "Billy?" "Yes, Len."
"I copied the whole thing."
"That's fine, Len," Starkey said tiredly. "You make your report as you see fit, of course."
"You don't understand, Billy," Len said. "You did the right thing. Don't you think I know that?"
Starkey let his eyes slip closed. For a moment, all the sweet downers deserted him.
"God bless you too, Len," he said, and his voice was close to breaking.
He switched off and went back to stand in front of Monitor 2. He put his hands behind his back like a blackjack Pershing reviewing troops. He regarded Frank D. Bruce and his final resting place. In a little while, he felt calm again. Going southeast out of Sipe Springs, if you get on U.S. 36, you are headed in the general direction of Houston, a day's drive away. The car burning up the road was a 3-year-old Pontiac Bonneville, doing 80, and when it came over the rise and saw the nondescript Ford blocking the road, there was nearly an accident. The driver, a 36-year-old stringer for a large Houston daily, tromped on the power brake and the tires began to screech, the Pontiac's nose first dipping down toward the road and then beginning to brake to the left. "Holy God!" the photographer in the shotgun seat cried. He dropped his camera to the floor and began to scramble his seatbelt across his middle. The driver let up on the brake, skirted the Ford on the shoulder, and then felt his left wheels start to drag in the soft dirt. He matted the gas pedal, and the Bonneville responded with more traction, dragging back onto the blacktop. Blue smoke squirted from beneath the tires. The radio blared on and on. "Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Baby, can you dig your man?" He tromped the brake again, and the Bonneville slewed to a stop in the middle of the hot and deserted afternoon. He drew in a ragged, terrified breath and then coughed it out in a series of bursts. He began to be angry. He threw the Pontiac into reverse and back toward the Ford and the two men standing behind it. "Listen," the photographer said nervously. He was fat and hadn't been in a fight since the 9th grade. "Listen, maybe we just better—" He was thrown forward with a grunt as the stringer brought the Pontiac to another screeching halt, threw the transmission lever into park with one hard thrust of his hand, and got out. He began to walk toward the two young men behind the Ford, his hands doubled into fists. "All right, motherfuckers," he shouted. "You almost got us fucking killed, and I want—" He had been in the service, 4 years in the Army, volunteer. He had just time to identify the rifles as the new M3As when they brought them up from below the rear deck of the Ford. He stood shocked in the hot Texas sunshine and made water in his pants. He began to scream, and in his mind he was turning to run back to the Bonneville, but his feet never moved. They opened up on him, and slugs blew out his chest and groin. As he dropped to his knees, holding both hands out mutely for mercy, a slug struck him an inch over his left eye and tore off the top of his head. The photographer, who had been twisted over the back seat, found it impossible to comprehend exactly what had happened until the two young men stepped over the stringer's body and began to walk toward him, rifles raised. He slid across the Pontiac's seat, warm bubbles of saliva collecting at the corners of his mouth. The keys were still in the ignition. He turned the car on and screamed out just as they began shooting. He felt the car lurch to the right as if a giant had kicked the left rear, and the wheel began to shimmy wildly in his hands. The photographer bounced up and down as the Bonneville pogoed up the road on the flat tire. A second later, the giant kicked the other side of the car. The shimmy got worse. Sparks flew off the blacktop. The photographer was whining. The Pontiac's rear tires shimmied and flapped like black rags. The two young men ran back to their Ford, whose serial number was listed among the multitude in the Army Vehicles Division at the Pentagon, and one of them drove it around in a tight swaying circle. The nose bounced wildly as it came off the shoulder and drove over the body of the stringer. The sergeant in the passenger seat sprayed a startled sneeze onto the windshield. Ahead of them, the Pontiac washing machined along on its two flat rear tires, the nose bouncing up and down. Behind the wheel, the fat photographer had begun to weep at the sight of the dark Ford growing in the rearview mirror. He had the accelerator pressed to the floor, but the Pontiac would do no more than 40, and it was all over the road. On the radio, Larry Underwood had been replaced by Madonna. Madonna was asserting that she was a material girl. The Ford swung around the Bonneville, and for one second of crystal hope, the photographer thought it was going to keep right on going, to just disappear over the desolate horizon and let him alone. Then it pulled back in, and the Pontiac's wildly jittering nose caught its mudguard. There was a scream of pulling metal. The photographer's head flew forward into the wheel, and blood sprayed from his nose. Throwing terrified, creaky-necked glances back over his shoulder, he slid across the warm plastic seat as if it were grease and got out on the passenger's side. He ran down the shoulder. There was a barbed wire fence, and he leaped over it, sailing up and up like a blimp. And he thought, "I'm going to make it. I can run forever." He fell down on the other side with his leg caught in the barbs. Screaming at the sky, he was still trying to free his pants and dimpled white flesh when the two young men came down the shoulder with their guns in their hands. "Why?" he tried to ask them, but all that came out of him was a low and helpless squawk, and then his brains exited the back of his head. There was no published report of disease or any other trouble in Sipe Springs, Texas, that day. Chapter 18. Nick opened the door between Sheriff Baker's office and the jail cells, and they started razzing him right off. Vincent Hogan and Billy Warner were in the two saltine box cells on Nick's left. Mike Childress was in one of the two on the right. The other was empty, and it was empty because Ray Booth, he of the purple LSU fraternity ring, had flown the coop.
"Hey, dummy," Childress called. "Hey, you fucking dummy, what's gonna happen to you when we get out of here, huh? What the fuck's gonna happen to you?"
"I'm personally gonna rip your balls off and stuff 'em down your throat until you strangle on 'em," Billy Warner told him. "You understand me?"
Only Vince Hogan didn't participate in the razzing. Mike and Billy didn't have too much use for him on this day, June 23rd, when they were to be taken up to the Calhoun County seat and jugged pending trial. Sheriff Baker had leaned on Vince, and Vince had spilled his yellow guts. Baker had told Nick he could get an indictment against these old boys, but when it got to a jury trial, it was going to be Nick's word against these three. Four if they picked up Ray Booth. Nick had gained a healthy respect for Sheriff John Baker these last couple of days. He was a 250-pound ex-farmer who was predictably called Big Bad John by his constituents. The respect Nick felt for him was not because Baker had given him this job, swamping out the holding area to make up for his lost week's pay, but because he had gone after the men who had beaten and robbed Nick. He had done it as if Nick were a member of one of the oldest and most respected families in town, instead of just a deaf-mute drifter. There were plenty of sheriffs here in the border south, Nick knew, who would have seen him on a work farm or road gang for 6 months instead. They had driven out to the sawmill where Vince Hogan worked, taking Baker's private car, a power wagon, instead of the county prowler car. There was a shotgun under the dash, always locked up and always loaded, Baker said, and a bubble light Baker put on the dash when he was on police business. He put it up there when they swung into the lumberyard parking area, 2 days ago now. Baker had hawked, spat out the window, blew his nose, and dabbed at his red eyes with a handkerchief. His voice had acquired a nasal foghorn quality. Nick couldn't hear it, of course, but he didn't need to. It was clear enough that the man had a nasty cold.
"Now, when we see him, I'll grab him by the arm," Baker said. "I'll ask you, is this one of 'em? You give me a big nod, yes. I don't care if it was or not. You just nod. Get it?"
Nick nodded. He got it. Vince was working the board planer, feeding rough planks into the machine, standing in sawdust almost to the top of his work boots. He gave John Baker a nervous smile, and his eyes flicked uneasily to Nick standing beside the sheriff. Nick's face was thin and battered and still too pale.
"Hey, Big John, what you doing out with the working folk?"
The other men in the crew were watching all this, their eyes shifting gravely from Nick to Vince to Baker, and then back the other way, like men watching some complicated new version of tennis. One of them spat a stream of honey cut into the fresh sawdust and wiped off his chin with the heel of his hand. Baker grabbed Vince Hogan by one flabby, sunburned arm and pulled him forward.
"Hey, what's the idea, Big John?"
Baker turned his head so Nick could see his lips.
"Is this one of 'em?"
Nick nodded firmly and pointed at Vince for good measure.
"What is this?" Vince protested again. "I don't know this dummy from Adam."
"Then how come you know he's a dummy? Come on, Vince, you're going to the cooler. Toot sweet. You can send one of these boys to get your toothbrush."
Protesting, Vince was led to the power wagon and deposited inside. Protesting, he was taken back to town. Protesting, he was locked up and left to stew for a couple of hours. Baker didn't bother with reading him his rights.
"Damn fool to just get confused," he told Nick.
When Baker went back around noon, Vince was too hungry and too scared to do any more protesting. He just spilled everything. Mike Childress was in the jug by 1 o'clock, and Baker got Billy Warner at his house just as Billy was packing up his old Chrysler to go someplace. A long piece from the look of all the packed liquor store boxes and strapped-together luggage. But somebody had talked to Ray Booth, and Ray had been just smart enough to move a little quicker. Baker took Nick home to meet his wife and have some supper. In the car, Nick wrote on the memo pad, "I am sure sorry it's her brother. How is she taking it?"
"She's bearing up," Baker said, both his voice and the set of his body almost formal. "I guess she's done some crying over him, but she knew what he was. And she knows you can't pick your relatives like you do your friends.
Jane Baker was a small, pretty woman who had indeed been crying. Looking at her deeply socketed eyes made Nick uncomfortable, but she shook his hand warmly and said, "I'm pleased to know you, Nick, and I apologize deeply for your trouble. I feel responsible with one of mine being a part of it and all." Nick shook his head and shuffled his feet awkwardly.
"I offered him a job around the place," Baker said. "Station's gone right to hell since Bradley moved up to Little Rock. Painting and picking up, mostly. He's going to have to stick around for a while anyway, for the, you know."
"The trial, yes," she said.
There was a moment then in which the silence was so heavy even Nick found it painful. Then, with forced gaiety, she said,
"I hope you eat red-eye ham, Nick. That's what there is, along with some corn and a big bowl of slaw. My slaw's never been up to what his mother used to make. That's what he says, anyway."
Nick rubbed his stomach and smiled.
Over dessert, a strawberry shortcake, Nick, who had been on short rations during the last couple of weeks, had two helpings. Jane Baker said to her husband, "Your cold sounds worse. You've been taking too much on, John Baker, and you didn't eat enough to keep a fly alive."
Baker looked guiltily at his plate for a moment, then shrugged. "I can afford to miss a meal now and then," he said, and palpated his double chin.
Nick, watching them, wondered how two people of such radically different size got along in bed. "I guess they manage," he thought with an interior grin. "They sure look comfortable enough with each other. And not that it's any of my business anyway."
"You're flush, too. You carrying a fever?"
Baker shrugged.
"Nope. Well, maybe a touch."
"Well, you're not going out again tonight. That's final."
"My dear, I have prisoners. If they don't specially need to be watched, they do need to be fed and watered."
"Nick can do it," she said with finality. "You're going to bed. And don't go on about your insomnia. It won't do you any good."
"I can't send Nick," he said weakly. "He's a deaf-mute. Besides, he ain't a deputy."
"Well, then you just up and deputize him."
"He ain't a resident."
"I won't tell if you won't," Jane Baker said inexorably. She stood up and began clearing the table. "Now you just go on and do it, John." And that was how Nick Andros went from show-yo prisoner to show-yo deputy in less than 24 hours. As he was preparing to go up to the sheriff's office, Baker came into the downstairs hall, looking large and ghostly in a frayed bathrobe. He seemed embarrassed to be on view in such attire.
"I never should have let her talk me into this," he said. "Wouldn't have done either if I didn't feel so punk. My chest's all clogged up, and I'm hot as a fire sale 2 days before Christmas. Weak, too."
Nick nodded sympathetically.
"I'm stuck between deputies. Bradley Cade and his wife went up to Little Rock after their baby passed away. One of those crib deaths. Awful thing. I don't blame them for going."
Nick pointed at his own chest and made a circle with his thumb and forefinger.
"Sure, you'll be okay. You just take normal care, you hear? There's a .45 in the third drawer of my desk, but don't you be taking it back there. Nor the keys either, understand?"
Nick nodded.
"If you go back there, stay out of their reach. If any of 'em tries playing sick, don't you fall for it. It's the oldest dodge in the world. If one of 'em should get sick, Doc Soames can see them just as easy in the morning. I'll be in then."
Nick took his pad from his pocket and wrote, "I appreciate you trusting me. Thanks for locking them up, and thanks for the job." Baker read this carefully.
"You're a pure decaution, boy. Where are you from? How come you're out on your own like this?"
"That's a long story," Nick jotted. "I'll write some of it down for you tonight if you want."
"You do that," Baker said. "I guess you know I put your name on the wire."
Nick nodded. It was S.O.P., but he was clean.
"I'll get Jane to call Ma's truck stop out by the highway. Those boys'll be hollering police brutality if they don't get their supper."
Nick wrote, "Have her tell whoever brings it to come right in. I can't hear him if he knocks."
"Okay."
Baker hesitated a moment longer.
"You got your cot in the corner. It's hard, but it's clean. You just remember to be careful, Nick.
You can't call for help if there's trouble.
Nick nodded and wrote, I can take care of myself.
Yeah, I believe you can. Still, I'd get someone from town if I thought any of them would...
He broke off as Jane came in.
You still jaw on this poor boy. You let him go on now before my stupid brother comes along and breaks them all out.
Baker laughed sourly.
He'll be in Tennessee by now, I guess.
He whistled out a long sigh that broke up into a series of phlegmy, booming coughs.
I believe I'll go upstairs and lie down, Janie.
I'll bring you some aspirin to cut that fever, she said.
She looked back over her shoulder at Nick as she went to the stairs with her husband.
It was a pleasure meeting you, Nick, whatever the circumstances. You be just as careful as he says.
Nick bowed to her, and she dropped half a curtsy in return. He thought he saw a gleam of tears in her eyes. A pimply, curious boy in a dirty busboy's jacket brought three dinner trays about half an hour after Nick had gotten down to the jail. Nick motioned for the busboy to put the trays on the cot, and while he did, Nick scribbled, Is this paid for? The busboy read this all with the concentration of a college freshman tackling Moby Dick.
Sure, he said. Sheriff's office runs a tab. Say, can't you talk?
Nick shook his head. That's a bitch, the busboy said, and left in a hurry as if the condition might be catching. Nick took the trays in one at a time and pushed each one through the slot in the bottom of the cell door with a broom handle. He looked up in time to catch, Chick shit bastard, ain't he? From Mike Childress. Smiling, Nick showed him his middle finger.
I'll give you the finger, you dummy, Childress said, grinning unpleasantly.
When I get out of here, I'll...
Nick turned away, missing the rest. Back in the office, sitting in Baker's chair, he drew the memo pad into the center of the blotter, sat thinking for a moment, and then jotted at the top, Life History, by Nick Andros. He stopped, smiling a little. He had been in some funny places, but never in his wildest dreams had he expected to be sitting in a sheriff's office, deputized, in charge of three men who had beaten him up, and writing his life story. After a moment, he began to write again. I was born in Castlin, Nebraska, November 14, 1968. My daddy was an independent farmer. He and my mom were always on the edge of getting squeezed out. They owed three different banks. My mother was 6 months pregnant with me, and my dad was taking her to see the doctor in town when a tie rod on his truck let go and they went into the ditch. My daddy had a heart attack and died. Anyway, 3 months after, my mom had me and I was born the way I am. Sure was a tough break on top of losing her husband that way. She carried on with the farm until 1973 and then lost it to the big operators, as she always called them. She had no family but wrote to some friends in Big Springs, Iowa, and one of them got her a job in a bakery. We lived here until 1977 when she was killed in an accident. A man on a motorcycle hit her while she was crossing the street on her way home from work. It wasn't even his fault, but only bad luck as his brakes failed. He wasn't even speeding or anything. The Baptist church gave my mama a charity funeral. This same church, the Grace Baptist, sent me to the Children of Jesus Christ Orphanage in Des Moines. This is a place that all sorts of churches chip together to support. That was where I learned to read and write. He stopped there. His hand was aching from writing so much, but that wasn't why. He felt uneasy, hot, and uncomfortable at having to relive all that again. He went back to the jail quarters and looked in. Childress and Warner were asleep. Vince Hogan was standing by the bars, smoking a cigarette and looking across the corridor at the empty cell where Ray Booth would have been tonight if he hadn't run so quick. Hogan looked as if he might have been crying, and that led him back in time to that small, mute scrap of humanity, Nick Andros. There was a word he had learned at the movies as a kid. That word was incommunicado. It was a word that had always had fantastic, Lovecraftian overtones to Nick, a fearful word that echoed and clanged in the brain, a word that inscribed all the nuances of fear that live only outside the sane universe and inside the human soul. He had been incommunicado all his life. He sat down and reread the last line he'd written. That was where I learned to read and write. But it hadn't been as simple as that. He lived in a silent world. Writing was code. Speech was the moving of lips, the rise and fall of teeth, the dance of a tongue. His mother had taught him to read lips, and had taught him how to write his name in struggling, sprawling letters. "That's your name," she had said. "That's you, Nicky." But of course she had said it silently, meaninglessly. The prime connection had come when she tapped the paper, then tapped his chest. The worst part about being deaf-mute was not living in the silent movie world. The worst part was not knowing the names of things. He had not really begun to understand the concept of naming until he was 4. He had not known that you called the tall green things trees until he was 6. He had wanted to know, but no one had thought to tell him, and he had no way to ask. He was incommunicado. When she died, he had retreated almost all the way. The orphanage was a place of roaring silence, where grim-faced thin boys made fun of his silence. 2 boys would run up to him, 1 boy with his hands plastered over his mouth, 1 boy with his hands plastered over his ears. If none of the staff happened to be near, they would punch him out. Why? No reason, except that maybe in the vast white class of victims there is a subclass, the victims of victims. He stopped wanting to communicate, and when that happened, the thinking process itself began to rust and disintegrate. He began to wander from place to place vacantly, looking at the nameless things that filled the world. He watched groups of children in the play yard move their lips, raise and lower their teeth like white drawbridges, dance their tongues in the ritual mating of speech. He sometimes found himself looking at a single cloud for as long as an hour at a time. Then Rudy had come, a big man with scars on his face and a bald head, 6 feet 5 inches tall. Might as well have been 20 to runty Nick Andros. They met for the first time in a basement room where there was a table, 6 or 7 chairs, and a TV that only worked when it felt like it. Rudy squatted, putting his eyes on approximately the same level as Nick's. Then he took his huge, scarred hands and put them over his mouth, his ears. "I am a deaf-mute." Nick turned his face sullenly away. "Who gives a fuck?" Rudy slapped him. Nick fell down. His mouth opened and silent tears began to leak from his eyes. He didn't want to be here with this scarred troll, this bald boogie. He was no deaf-mute, it was a cruel joke. Rudy pulled him gently to his feet and led him to the table. A blank sheet of paper was there. Rudy pointed at it, then at Nick. Nick stared sullenly at the paper and then at the bald man. He shook his head. Rudy nodded and pointed at the empty paper again. He produced a pencil and handed it to Nick. Nick put it down as if it were hot. He shook his head. Rudy pointed at the pencil, then at Nick, then at the paper. Nick shook his head. Rudy slapped him again. More silent tears. The scarred face looking at him with nothing but deadly patience. Rudy pointed at the paper again, at the pencil, at Nick. Nick grasped the pencil in his fist. He wrote the 4 words that he knew, calling them forth from the cobwebby, rusty mechanism that was in his thinking brain. He wrote, "Nicholas Andros, fuck you." Then he broke the pencil in half and looked sullenly and defiantly at Rudy. But Rudy was smiling. Suddenly, he reached across the table and held Nick's head steady between his hard, calloused palms. His hands were warm, gentle. Nick could not remember the last time he had been touched with such love. His mother had touched him like that. Rudy removed his hands from Nick's face. He picked up the half of the pencil with the point on it. He turned the paper over to the blank side. He tapped the empty white space with the tip of the pencil, and then tapped Nick. He did it again, and again, and again. And finally, Nick understood. "You are this blank page." Nick began to cry. Rudy came for the next 6 years. Where I learned to read and write. A man named Rudy Sparkman came to help me. I was very lucky to have him. In 1984, the orphanage went broke. They placed as many kids that they could, but I was not one of them. They said I would get in with a family after a while and the state would pay them for keeping me. I wanted to go with Rudy, but Rudy was in Africa working for the Peace Corps. So I ran away. Being 16, I don't think they looked for me too hard. I figured if I could stay out of trouble, I would be all right, and so far, so good. I've been taking the high school correspondence courses one at a time, because Rudy always said education is the most important. When I settle down for a while, I'm going to take that high school equivalency test. I will be able to pass it soon. I like school. Maybe I will go to college someday. I know that sounds crazy, a deaf-mute bum like me, but I don't think it's impossible. Anyway, that's my story. Yesterday morning, Baker had come in around 7:30 while Nick was emptying waste baskets. The sheriff looked better. "How you feeling?" Nick wrote.
"Pretty good. I was burning up until midnight. Worst fever I've had since I was a kid. Aspirin didn't seem to help it. Janie wanted to call the doc, but around 12:30 the fever just broke. I slept like a log after that. How are you doing?"
Nick made a thumb and forefinger circle.
"How's our guests?"
Nick opened and closed his mouth several times in a mime jabbering, looked furious, made banging gestures on invisible bars. Baker threw back his head and laughed, then sneezed several times.
"You ought to be on TV," he said.
"Did you write your life story down like you said you was going to try to do?" Nick nodded and handed the two sheets of longhand over. The sheriff sat down and read them carefully. When he was done, he looked at Nick so long and so piercingly that Nick stared down at his feet for a moment, embarrassed and confused. When he looked up again, Baker said, "You've been on your own since you were 16? For 6 years?" Nick nodded. "And you've really taken all these high school courses?" Nick wrote for some time on one of the memo sheets. "I was way behind because I started to read and write so late. When the orphanage closed, I was just starting to catch up. I got 6 HS credits from there and another 6 since then from LaSalle in Chicago. I learned about them from a matchbook cover. I need 4 more credits."
"What courses do you still need?" Baker asked, then turned his head and shouted, "Shut up in there! You'll get your hot cakes and coffee when I'm damn good and ready and not before."
Nick wrote, "Geometry, advanced math, 2 years of a language. Those are the college requirements."
"A language? You mean like French, German, Spanish?"
Nick nodded. Baker laughed and shook his head.
"Don't that beat all? A deaf mute learning to talk a foreign language. Nothing against you, boy, you understand that?"
Nick smiled and nodded.
"So why you been drifting around so much?"
"While I was still a minor, I didn't dare stay in one place for too long," Nick wrote. "Afraid they'd try to stick me in another orphanage or something. When I got old enough to look for a steady job, times got worse. They said the stock market crashed or something, but since I'm deaf, I didn't hear it. Ha ha."
"Most places would have just let you ramble on," Baker said. "In hard times, the milk of human kindness don't flow so free, Nick. As for a steady job, I might be able to put you onto something around here. Unless those boys soured you on Shoyo and Arkansas for good. But we ain't all like that."
Nick nodded to show he understood.
"How's your teeth? That was quite a shot in the mouth you took."
Nick shrugged.
"Take any of those pain pills?"
Nick held up 2 fingers.
"Well, look, I got some paperwork to do on those boys. You go on with what you were doing. We'll talk more later."
Dr. Soames, the man who had almost hit Nick with his car, came by around 9:30 a.m. the same morning. He was a man of about 60, with shaggy white hair, a scrawny chicken neck, and very sharp blue eyes.
"Big John tells me you read lips," he said.
"He also says he wants to see you gainfully employed, so I guess I better make sure you're not going to die on his hands. Take off your shirt." Nick unbuttoned his blue work shirt and took it off.
"Holy Jesus, look at him," Baker said.
"They did a job of work, all right." Soames looked at Nick and said dryly, "Boy, you almost lost your left tit." He pointed to a crescent-shaped scab just above the nipple.
Nick's belly and rib cage looked like a Canadian sunrise. Soames poked and prodded him and looked carefully into the pupils of his eyes. At last he examined